since you that he's
wrong. That Olam Haba is a fantasy.
Right.
So how am I going to believe it?
100%. 100%. But I want to tell you, I have never, as of now, I have never met an ideological certain atheist. I'm looking for them. I'm really looking for a real argument with a real atheist. So now someone who is committed, who is 100% certain that what I believe is nonsense. I want to meet him. I've never met such a person yet.
I'm not saying we have to have this uncertain. I'm saying it reduces the odds.
It doesn't matter. That's why I mentioned 10%. It doesn't have to be a Sofek HaShoko. Even if it's a possibility of 1 out of 10. Right?
But you could carry that farther and say, since nobody has ever witnessed, nor does, it's not, you can't see their microscope, nobody has ever witnessed this mysterious world.
So what? But it's a possible world.
Therefore, I don't take that into the statistics. Not
well, that doesn't make sense. I mean, if it's a possible world.
Rabban says that on the Rista, the Chabez, the Shoim, that they did not believe anything. Where they couldn't feel with their hands?
That's part of the research. That's part of the subjectivity. In other words, since you want to commit yourself to a better life, so your Yetzer Hora doesn't allow you to hear this argument. Right? But if you present it to him, there is no actual counter-argument. The only counter-argument is this. I believe it's definitely nonsense. That is the only real counter-argument. The point is, even though it's such a logical argument, there are some people who are unwilling to listen to this argument. Oh, that makes them a Russia. That's only because you are, it's a Russia. That's the point. But an actual counter-argument, there is no counter-argument to this, except if he tells you that he's a believing atheist. You know that atheism is a religion. Right? There is no one as, you know, closed-minded as an atheist, probably, I imagine, right? He's not willing to listen to any other side. Yeah.
You need to offer a comparable case to what we're talking about. Let's say somebody who had a very bad illness and has an opportunity to take an operation because he has a chance of working, not a very good chance. Or a person says, there's another option. Somebody comes over to him and says, I know of a different type of a sign that exists. No one has ever heard of it before. But this science has almost 100% success rate. Now, the person has never heard of the science before. Would he be foolish to choose what he has heard of because it has a small possibility of working? Or should he go for what I'm telling him exists, which he's never heard of and doesn't believe? But I know, I'm telling him, I know that this has a very high percentage. It's almost for sure you'll be cured with this.
You know, if he has confidence in you or he doesn't have confidence in you, you mean? No, that's the crucial point. Does he have confidence in you? And I'm not just mentioning this, the confidence part, because this is another crucial point here.
Why is it?
The main point is that you have to develop the sense that he trusts you. But he has to trust you that such a thing exists.
But that's my point. That this in itself can't work without a trust. And if it's built on a trust, then it's not a proof.
Well, it's not so. It's not exactly so. You mean, even the alternative you mean is a non-existent until...
And then it's not a proof, it's a trust.
Exactly. But there is something else. It's the knowledge that Judaism exists. It's also something. Which means... It's not something that out of the blue I come to and say, you know, there's a religion called Judaism? Yeah, I never heard of it. Right? And then, yeah, there is, and you have to do mitzvahs, you have to put on tefillin. Says, yeah? Really? Okay. And then trust is crucial. Of course, trust is very important, but after all, Judaism is something that he probably knows exists. Right? So it's a little bit different than what you are talking about. Right? The analogy would be, but there is a science. When somebody tells you, you know, the Chinese have been using this and this method for years and it works, right? Why don't you try that? Right? Then, of course, the combination. I know the Chinese. I know that they have acupuncture, for instance, and that it does. I heard that for them it does work. I never considered it as an alternative. But now that you mention it, the combination of my trust in you, your mentioning it, and my knowledge that the Chinese use acupuncture, could make me change my mind. That's it. That would be a good analogy. Right? Now, by the way, many people ask, but doesn't it say that emuno is only an emuno shleimo? What does it mean, ani mamin be emuno shleimo? You ever tell you a pshat in ani mamin be emuno shleimo? You ever tell you a pshat? Could be that I mention it to you. What does it mean, ani mamin be emuno shleimo? Does ani mamin be emuno shleimo mean that I'm not allowed to have any doubts at all? Or is there room in belief in emuno for doubts? Or is it a contradiction? Right. A person says, and that is something that comes up very, very often. Somebody tells you, listen, I believe and I'm committed, but I can't help it. I have doubts. Does that make me an eno mamin? What do you answer to such a thing? Right? Yeah?
The very definition of I believe means I believe. I'm not 100% sure.
You're 100% right, but that's very, very few people take it that way.
I think
very many people mistakenly believe that there is a contradiction between emuno and doubt. Right? But that's what I want to tell you. You're 100% right. There is no contradiction. I'll explain to you right away. Yeah?
I believe that this world defined emuno. Whatever Seichel can understand is not in the tchum of emuno. That's the idea. That a person has to understand alone. What Seichel cannot be mastered, that is not emuno.
That's exactly. It's 100% right. I never heard of Bishem de Biskero, but it's 100%. So it's obviously him is what he's saying. In other words, that today is Thursday. Tonight is Thursday night is not emuno. Right? That now it's dark outside, it's not emuno. That 2 and 2 is 4 is not emuno. It's like it says, you know, in Chazal say, Lahagid baboiker chazdecho vemunos ho baleilois. Right? You say in the morning, you know, when things are clear, when you see things clearly, then you can see the chesed of Hashem. At night, when everything is dark, you can't see the chesed of Hashem. So when is there emuno? At night there is emuno. In the day there is yediyah, there is no emuno. Lehagid baboiker chazdecho vemunos ho baleilois. Hashem Elokeichem memes, what do we say in the morning? V'yatziv v'nochon v'kayom, all synonyms of an established fact. What do we say at night? V'emuno kol zois. Because at night, Hashem Elokeichem memes is connected to emuno, because you have to make what the philosophers call the leap of faith. Because it's not a yedio bro, right? It's a commitment to something. That's why Hashem Elokeichem emes v'emuno, that's only at night. During the day, it's beyond the emuno, it's yedio, right? Of course, there is such a thing as an emuno, which is as intense as the yedio. But I use the following analogy. Let's say, for instance, a surgeon has to think whether yes to make the operation or not to make the operation. So we weigh the possibilities. I may yes make the operation and this will come out, but if he does succeed, he will have a better life, or I may not make the operation, and if I don't make the operation, he may live anyway. I mean, so he has all kinds of tzedot in yes to make the operation and not to make the operation. Let's give it values. He adds values on this side of the scale, comes out 60-40 that he should make the operation. 60-40. But just by giving it numbers. So he decides he's going for it, right? Or 70-30, whatever. Okay? While he's making the operation, does his uncertainty affect his commitment to the operation? In other words, will he do 70% of the cure? It's ridiculous. Obviously, you make 100% commitment to the 70% chance. You know what I mean? Which means, the chances are really 70%, but my commitment is 100%. Right? In other words, ani mamin b'emuno shleimo doesn't mean I have no uncertainty. I can have as many uncertainties as I want. Doesn't matter. But my commitment is to the tzad that it's emes. Which means that there is no contradiction at all between doubts and emuno. Emuno has to do with your commitment to something. Right? Your doubts in your head, you're allowed to have as many doubts as you want, as long as your commitment is to 100%, like the doctor making the operation. He still has doubts, but it doesn't affect his commitment. Now, as far as termina shemaim, there is the classical argument, which is very, very powerful. If you develop the skill of bringing it out, this can even be a good argument, both for Torah min HaShemayim and, of course, for the existence of God, because one is telling the other, right? If Torah is min HaShemayim, there has to be a Shemayim, right? Except some people say, you know, that there was the one of the criticisms on some Hasidim. They say, this Hasid, he has a emuno shleimo in his Rebbe, that his Rebbe has Ruach HaKodesh. He's not so sure there is a God, but for sure his Rebbe has Ruach HaKodesh. This is one of the criticisms. You know, like, and there are, I mean, I don't know if you ever met this paradox. A man who believes blindly in his Rebbe, but from his actions, you see, he's not a real Maimin Bashem, you know, but Lemaise, if you prove to someone Terem in Hashemayim, logically, right, he has to believe in Hashem. The way I express it, this is something which is already mentioned in the Kuzari, in the Hakdome of the Sefer Achinuch, but the way I present it is the following way. Each one should develop his own skill in presenting it, but if you present it well, it's very powerful argument. I called it the theory of the first fool. What does it mean, the theory of the first fool? Point is like this. If I believe in something, like if I know something, for instance, I know that George Washington was a president in the United States. I know that. If you analyze how I know that, it will come out that for specific reasons. Because this and this teacher told me, I read it in this book, and I read it in the New York Times, and I read it here, and I read it there. Right. So if somebody will say, nah, it's all a plot to convince you that there was a president called George Washington. Now, I would reject it immediately. I would say, why would anybody want to fool me? I know my parents told me there was a president George Washington. My teachers told me. There is no reason for them to fool me, right? Ah, counter-argument. Your parents themselves were convinced by someone that there was a George Washington. They really believed that, but somebody convinced them. Oh, so go one step further. The people who convinced them, why should have they convinced my parents that there was a man called George Washington? Right? It's so illogical. So obviously you have to come up with the following answer. There must have been a first one who was a complete fool. And that complete naive fool accepted blindly what he was told, and then he told it over to his children. Now, in order to apply this to Torah min Hashemayim, you have to go a lot further. You must create the following scenario. Right? In order to deny Torah min Hashemayim, now it's Maimad Har Sinai, in order to deny it, you have to say that at some point between Sinai and today, right, someone came to the to all our ancestors, right, and told them, you see this book? No, we never saw it before in our lives. Ah, this is the book that your ancestors received on Mount Sinai. Right? And that obligates you to put on tefillin every day and to keep Shabbos. And they all said, really? What a surprise. My parents never told me this. Oh yeah, you have to. Ah, okay, let's accept it. Our parents, our forefathers were in Sinai. So my children will have to do it. In other words, a whole generation suddenly became extremely naive and foolish, and they all accepted from some trickster, right, such an incredible theory. Is that possible? If that is very illogical, what is the only other alternative? That it actually happened. There is no other alternative. If you don't accept the theory of the first fool, then the only other alternative is the fact Maimad Har Sinai really happened. There is no other alternative in the middle. Do you get the point? Yeah? Yeah.
Then you can have a counter-argument and you see the same thing happen in Christianity.
No, you don't. I mean, usually you have that, you know, it's a common thing. Right away they ask you this, right? They ask you this. What about the Muslims and the Christians? They claim the same thing. Someone who made a study of comparative religions found the following incredible fact. Incredible. Every single religion in the world, besides the Jewish religion, are all based on one person. Not two, not three, one. That's all. Right? In other words, the whole Christianity is based on Paul, right? That's all. In other words, he claims that he got a view of that from now on you don't have to accept the Torah, and it's a, you know, whatever. What about if he either was lying or he was fooled? And obviously, it's one person. I mean, how reliable is one person? Islam, obviously, one person.
Fool the whole book.
Fine, but they all accept. that it's one person. We are the only Nechutzofin, right? That we claim that at least 4 million people, our ancestors, were all there. It wasn't one, it wasn't two, it's 4 million. You hear? What are the chances that 4 million were all fooled, as opposed to the fact that one person was fooled, right?
It could be that one person was fooled, that there were 4 million.
That why?
There was the first fool who was fooled that he had 4 million ancestors who were...
But I don't understand. How did he transfer that? At which time did the 4 million become one?
There was no 4 million.
It was only one. It was only one.
There was one claiming there was 4 million.
Who made it up, right? And he came to whom?
To somebody.
To other ancestors.
Someone like Paul, who's very powerful and consistent.
One person. Okay, now, do we have, first of all, we must have had a record of that. Moshe Rabbeinu. Who was it? Moshe Rabbeinu. Look, it says in the book that we were there. In other words, again, you're accepting the first fool theory. The first fool, right? You know, all our ancestors, at a certain point, in other words, in order to go back to one, you have to go back before Har Sinai. After Har Sinai, we were a people. So he came to our ancestors, and they all accepted that even though their parents never told them this, right, there was a Maimon Har Sinai with 4 million people, and so you have to accept the first fool theory.
And you see it happened by Paul.
No, it didn't. It never happened by Paul.
He
didn't fool anybody. They all said, Paul says such and such. I mean, he didn't fool anybody. Do you understand what I'm saying? Meaning, he didn't fool anybody. He presented the facts to people. People accepted his facts. And they say over, we heard from Paul such and such. They don't say, we heard it from God. They say, we heard it from Paul. Which means, you can't fool a whole world. Right? We are the only ones who tried to fool a whole world that 4 million people were there. We are the only one with the chutzpah of making such a claim. So it's one of the two. Either it's an outrageous chutzpah or it's true. One of the two. It's a powerful argument. Think about it. It's an extremely powerful argument.
We all came from Amor. We all stem from one person. At one point or another, they say, and maybe that one person...
That's the point. You know, in many sforim it says, why wasn't the Torah given to Avraham Avinu? Mm-hmm. Because he was one.
Okay, but
and we
given,
didn't want one.
One. So if you fooled one person, then he can tell his theorists that they're all...
But you can't. In other words...
Maimon Har Sinai was offered.
Right. In other words...
I have a guy who said I was at Har Sinai.
But that's the point. In other words, again, you have to say that they came to our ancestors, and again, they fooled our ancestors that there were 4 million people. So again, you are basing the whole theory on the theory of the first fool. So that's what the way you have to present it. If this is acceptable to you, it's possible that all our ancestors were naive fools. There is such a possibility. We can't prove otherwise. But if it's reasonable to you, okay. Fine. So then deny Maimon Har Sinai. But if that possibility is unreasonable to you, you must admit the only other possibility is that it's MS. So if you want to live with that first fool theory, I can deny it to you. I can't refuse it. I can't reject it. But if that doesn't satisfy you, right, then you have no choice but to accept Torah Min HaShamayim. Now it's Maimon Har Sinai. Yeah?
This isn't foolproof, but I could imagine that someone would ask this in an audience that at the end of World War II, the whole world saw that the destruction and havoc.
Basically, you are right. That's what the Enlightenment is saying. But remember, we are not in the Enlightenment anymore. And those people committed to the belief that we are modern, our ancestors are primitive. That is changing now. In other words, we are developing respect for our ancestors. There's a return to more respect to our ancestors. In the Haskoleh, there was an extreme of the other side, right? It was a complete putting down of our ancestors. Our ancestors knew nothing, we know everything. Now there is a feeling of respect of the ancestors. So it's true. The Haskoleh Jew, the Maskil, can live with that. Yeah, my ancestors were dumb and naive. Yeah. And they accepted the foolish theory that there was a mind at Har Sinai. Yeah. But the Jew today, he's only an unbeliever out of inertia. If you present them with the facts, the chances are that it will hit them. It will hit them. Remember, we are away from that ideological commitment of the Enlightenment. It's gone. It's gone forever. That's it.
Standard college kid today believes that his parents were, that they might be nice people worthy of respect. I should get him a glass of water when they ask. But ask them whether their grandparents or great-grandparents were doing the right thing when they believed in all these weird superstitions. They'll still tell you that they were sold a load of...
They were wrong, but the extreme of feeling that they were primitive savages that you had in a century and a half ago, that was actually what they expressed. Actually, our primitive savage ancestors, you don't have anymore. There is much more respect now in a Jew for his ancestry than the masculine, than the average masculine. I don't know if you ever read Haskoleh literature. It's disgusting, you know. It's not only lack of respect for the ancestry, it's hatred for the ancestry. It's an actual feeling of hatred. It's as if we blame our ancestry for all the problems we had being Jewish. So there was an actual hatred. You don't have that anymore, you know, the hatred of my ancestors because I'm Jewish. Just the opposite. I'm very proud of being Jewish.
That's the natural reaction for what they consider emancipation.
That was the problem with emancipation. Emancipation was a whole blaming trip for our ancestors. For
what they were doing.
Exactly. That was the idea. You don't have that anymore. If you have that, you can't argue anything. You know, there is no argument at all. You're absolutely right. To the masculine, you have no argument. Right. But today it's different. We don't masculine them anymore. You know. Okay, now, to start the next subject, it's a little bit late. Any other questions on this subject, Termina Shemayim, yeah? This is
the question. The point that was made that to have a movement does not necessarily mean to be 100% sure.
Right.
But at the same time, to say that a person is going to do 100% the Torah and have a large suffering is hard to come by, isn't it?
Why? Why?
Because it means a tremendous amount of serious nefesh at time and commitment.
Yeah.
And
for the chance that it's true.
But speaking from a just realistic point of view, it's good if everything is going smoothly with a person who's trying to keep the Torah, fine. So he can say, I'll keep the Torah even though I'm not sure. But when things start to become difficult, and he has to make decisions of which way to go...
You are right. At that time, you're 100% right. Therefore, your obligation in such a situation is to minimize the doubt. Of course.
Question,
of course.
How do you do that?
Well, of course. I mean, that's part of the process, to minimize the doubt. But I'm just saying that the first commitment, which is the crucial commitment, the first step of the commitment does not require the removal of doubts. Right? That's what I mean. Now, if you wanted to make that step, you want him to make that step, the first commitment, and he says, but I can't, I have so many doubts. Say, okay, it's okay. You can have as many doubts as you want. Then you present to him this risk-reward ratio, and then he feels comfortable becoming committed in spite of his doubts. And you know the klal is tamo ureu kitoy Hashem, that somehow the doing mitzvahs will eventually, little by little, it makes the questions, the doubts, irrelevant. You know the famous pshat that the Malbim gives on Iyov, he had a lot of questions, right? And then at the end he says, Hamishma oizen shmaticho, the questions, at the end Hashem appears to Iyov. So he said, the reason why I have questions is because I only heard about you. the actor Einai Risiho, now my experience is so real that all of a sudden the question disappeared. So no matter what do you mean? But the questions are still there. Where is the justice? Right? All of a sudden, your feeling of certainty takes away the questions, even though you don't have an answer. But little by little, takes it away.
Isn't that what we call self-perception and brainwashing?
Yes, yes, but it's the good side of it. You understand? I mean, it is, and there's no question about it. There's no question about it. It's self-suggestion, and sometimes it can be used in the good side. Right? That is the good side of it. Right? Exactly. You can use it in order to become a committed communist, right? Or you can use it to become a committed Jew. Right? But you have the choice, and it's to allow yourself to become brainwashed. But that is a commitment that you should make, by the way. Right? Because the eventual disappearance of all doubts is only through self-suggestion and brainwashing. But it's something that you have a choice to allow yourself to get into it. To the point that all of a sudden that doubts disappear, right? Even though they are there, but they disappear, they dissipate. Yeah.
I don't want to be faced with this one. In terms of my ancestors had to believe that 4 million people were there, why don't we just convince, let's say, like, not 4 million, 100,000 people. Moshe Rabbeinu is very charismatic. He has a group of elders. He has a few people. It makes logical. We live together. We make laws. It makes a lot of sense. It's humanistic. It's moral. It's fair. It's ethical. And we say that it was given by God, but it wasn't really given by God. We all made up. Yeah, we'll tell it to our children, and we'll tell it that they all got it from Hashem. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you don't have to convince anybody anymore. Once you convince only the first generation, 100,000 people, or 20,000
people. Remember, those people have to get together to agree, all of them, to give over the same tradition to the next generation.
On a fraud,
exactly. If that's logical, again, is the theory. If they were all fooled into accepting that commitment, fine, okay, we have no argument against it. But does that make sense to you? That all our ancestors all agreed? Look at the book itself, look at Korach, right? If there would be any doubt about Maimon Har Sinai, this man would have accepted it, right? Right? No, I'm saying like the Korah, the story of Korah is the biggest riot for Torah Min HaShemayim, right? Because Lemaise, he never said that Torah is not Min HaShemayim. He never said it. He never said that Moshe Rabbeinu made up the Torah. Most he could argue was that Moshe Rabbeinu gave certain positions to certain people. He never argued that Moshe Rabbeinu made up the Torah. If there would be any chance of arguing that Moshe Rabbeinu made up the Torah, wouldn't Korach come up with that possibility?
If right? He would have made it up, they wouldn't have put that in the book.
Fine, but remember, one thing we sense about the Torah, I mean, but it's getting a little bit too complex, because one thing we do sense about the Torah is the complete objectivity of the Torah. Now, that's a tremendous argument. That's the complete objectivity of the Torah, which means all flaws, all problems are never covered up, right? If there was a problem, Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake, so he made a mistake. It's right there. Right? Korach, whatever happened by Korach, there was a revolution. It's right there. We don't create ideal situations in the book, right? Everything was perfect. No, everything is open, honest, right here. But that itself gives you a feeling of certainty that what it says actually happened. Because why should you try to... If there was it's megamati. What do you call megamati? In other words, if the whole book is how do you translate megamati? If it like a book with a certain
goal-oriented, right?
What? Goal-oriented, meaning it has the goal. The goal is to convince you. It would have covered up all the bad parts. Like it would have covered up Moshe Rabbeinu making a mistake. I mean, I have to rely on Moshe Rabbeinu, the same Moshe Rabbeinu who hits the stone. Well, you know. I have to accept that my ancestors, tried to kill each other, right? Why? You know, why don't we all cover it up? If it's all a plot, they would have written a much better book. Right?
That's a different argument. That's not the argument of the Kuzari.
Well, it's part of the argument of the Kuzari. Part of the argument of the Kuzari. He doesn't actually say that, but it's in there. The absolute objectivity of the Torah, right?
That's once the book, to me, that's a better argument than the argument.
Well, it's part of the argument, because the whole argument is the book. Given the book and say, could this book by its very nature, be made up by someone and sold to a whole generation. Look at the nature of it. It doesn't say what is there in the book that makes it impossible to be so. That's I'm adding. The complete objectivity of Torah is overwhelming, right? If somebody's trying to sell someone something, he wouldn't write a Torah. It's ridiculous. It's not a book that can be sold. Right? I mean, my ancestors made this and this mistake. I mean, the New Testament would write such a thing about, you know, Paul. And I mean, it's ridiculous. Would the Quran write about, you know, out of the question. They were all perfect. All of a sudden, you see, they're all human. It's part of the argument that this book is not a book that you can just fool people into accepting. It's either it happened or it's not. Yeah.
Humanistic argument. I mean, so my son close to me says it's humanistic. It's ethical. It's logical. People got together. It's beautiful.
The truth of the matter is, it's not humanistic at all. I mean, why is the Torah humanistic? Right? The Torah says that you destroy all the Canaanites. What's humanistic about that? It doesn't say that you make peace with the Canaanites. It says you get rid of them, right? You get rid of Amalek. Where's the humanism of it? By the way, I don't know if you saw, there was in this week's Time magazine. Did anybody have a chance to see it? Right?
You want a copy of it?
Oh, you have it here, right here?
I made a copy for Absolutely.
Oh. did you read that argument about we have to do better than Yeshua? I mean, it's a beautiful. I mean, we are talking about a so-called Orthodox Jew, a philosopher. Can you, if you have the thing, can you read it? What's his name? Can you read that part? It's an incredible thing. It's an incredible statement. You're talking about humanism. We are more humanistic than God. That's what the man is arguing, right?
Oh, he quotes it, right? Joshua didn't convene an international peace conference. He just drove out the pagans out. We must find a different way.
Here, we must find a different way. You're the argument. In other words,
who's the attribution?
Who's saying that?
Yeah.
An Orthodox philosopher. How is he quoted? How is he described as the greatest philosopher, Jewish philosopher of our generation? How is it quoted?
No, that's Steinbach.
Oh, is that?
In a nation where state and religion are often indistinguishable, Hartman's question transcends academic.
Of David Hartman.
Right. Right. David Hartman wants to create that Torah that's really, really humanistic. He doesn't like God's Torah. He wants, you know, that's what he says. That you're
religious philosophy.
Right?
What's
his
recommendation?
To do better than Joshua? Yeah, we have to do better.
We have to do better than Joshua. That's what I'm saying. The Torah is not humanistic. We are. So we have to create our own humanistic Torah. So it's not, you know, the Torah is not so humanistic.
If you're going to say that I can have doubts and still be fully committed, that's fine if I'm going to do mitzvahs, but when it comes to certain mitzvahs that have to do that I believe, how can you tell me if I have doubts that then there's a mitzvah and Imam and the Munish Lamed, they're going to take me to Din B'cheshbon if I didn't believe in Mashiach? I had doubts in the whole thing to begin with.
Sure, but in your actions, do you commit yourself to Mashiach or not?
What does that have to do with my
it means I am committed 100% to his coming. I'll do everything that is required, right? But I doubt. I still have doubts. What does that have to do with
I
it?
I have doubts whether he's coming. That's not an imam.
That's what I'm saying. An imam means I'm committed 100% to the idea. The same whether the doctor is committed that the operation is right. Does he have doubts? Of course, but he's still committed to it. Yeah.
If at all, have you used the argument that the Gemara gives for the proof the Gemara gives for Kavod Shamayim?
Which? The arguments. The point is, I don't know enough about zoology to be able to use it. I hate to use arguments that I know very, very little about, because it just might happen that somebody knows about it more than me, and that's it. I'm lost. So I don't use, you know, that the Gemara says what the Moshe Rabbeinu. How did he know that there was no animal which with the two simo, the, with the with one simen that besides the chazir, you know, with the split hooves besides the chazir? How did he know? Right. Fine. I mean. Then there are problems. I don't know if you know the problem with the rabbit. There's a major problem. This is why it's very dangerous to use it. You know that according to the Torah, the shofon is one of those animals That according to what does it say in Parsha Shmini?
Maligero is not Mapris Parsha.
It's Maligero,
and it's not
Mapris Parsha. The truth of the matter is that the Shofon is not Maligero.
So there was a different Shofon.
Oh, so that's why. Oh, that is a different Shofon. Once you say that, you have destroyed the argument. You see, our argument is, you see, we know exactly, and Moshe Rabbeinu knew
that. What a Shofon was.
Oh, exactly. So that's the point. So the point is, whatever counter argument you are going to say, oh, so that is a different animal.
No, not the rabbit. Who told you? How do you know that a rabbit?
I don't know that. I don't know.
So what are you arguing
against? You're 100% right. But if so, right? If so, you have destroyed the Gemara's argument. Why? What does the Gemara say? It must be Torah min Hashomayim, because Moshe Rabbeinu says, right, that the chazir is the only animal, right, who has split hoofs. Right, and not Maligeo, the only animal. How did he know that in China they won't find another one? How do you know what a chazir is? Maybe that animal that you are going to find, you're going to call a chazir.
But still, there are more than
one. Why? I mean, you're going to call all of them chazir. Why not? I mean, maybe a chazir is a type which includes both. You have destroyed the argument. In other words, the moment you use that, you have destroyed the argument. This is why it's so dangerous. So I personally never use that. Even though I know in the discovery program they do use it. That's what they told me, and I don't know what they do about the Shofon. You know, by the way, the Torah Shleimo.
Shofon v'anevis, it says.
Yeshua v'anevis, but the rabbit doesn't fit into either one of them, and it's very difficult that all of a sudden we lost the tradition of what a Shofon is. It's very, very difficult, but there is in the Torah Shleimo. You know, in the Torah Shleimo in the back, he is a beautiful, beautiful pshat. It's a beautiful, beautiful pshat, which, again, I would have to ask an expert whether it's true, because if it's true, it's amazing. The rabbit, supposedly, when he dug his needs, right, afterwards, eats part of what he came out of him. So he says, wait a second. Maybe that's pshat maligero. How do you know what maligero? Maligero means that he uses twice the same food. Maybe that's pshat using twice the same food. That's male.
It takes back.
That's exactly the pshat. It's an amazing pshat. And if it's true, it's tremendous. Right? I don't know. I never checked it out. But if you're an expert in the area, use it. Right? If not, keep away from arguments that you're not an expert in.